So, hi, and welcome to another episode of the Foss North podcast. Today we have George with us, and we found a blog from him regarding dual licensing. We want to talk about it. So, who are you and why are you interested in this, George?
So, currently, well, I'm a guy that writes stuff on the internet and writes code, but currently the thing that makes me a bit interested in the topic is the fact that for the last year and a half, I've been working, like currently one of the engineering leads on an open source project that is, well, has been for the last almost year, I guess, licensed under GPL and is a commercial endeavor in that we can license it under proprietary licenses to various companies that want to use it in, you know, products where they don't necessarily want to be subject to the GPL, and we can add features to it without releasing the public, because again, we are adding those to a proprietary licensed versions where we don't have to merge the changes into upstream, so to speak. So that's kind of the interest that got me in there, but also the fact that I just see it as a very nice business model in general. And I was quite surprised actually when this happened, like I think 2 years ago, when people were kind of mad that Redis was switching towards this model, right? Of basically copy left for me, but not for D kind of style after AWS refused to pay the money. And I was surprised at like how negative the sentiment was. So I really wanted to just give a bit of thoughts, like, you know, okay, let me think, is this actually any bad? And honestly, I can't find much reason why it is. So that was kind of my motivation to some extent.
I mean, the challenge, I think, from let's dive in with the AWS here. So the challenge there, I think, was that they didn't preserve the open source nature of the license, I think, because it was targeted. You broke one of the basic freedoms that you can't use it for all purposes or something like that. I mean, the other way to do dual licensing is to have a very, very strong and open copyleft that sort of prevents proprietary endeavors around it, like GPL or... Yeah,
exactly. You can use it for all purposes, but if there is any money involved, like, you know, free or, you know, any proprietary software involved, like anywhere near it, then it's illegal suddenly.
Yeah, exactly.
But how does it work with the GPL in this way? Because this is a freedom you're not taking from the user of it, isn't it?
I guess. No, but I guess the what AWS did was, since it's as a service, it doesn't trigger the distribution. So that's the interesting part.
Okay.
Yeah, and Redis was kind of not under a AGPL type license, so it never triggered, yeah.
Okay.
But George, how do you handle the logistics around this? Because I guess you need to be the copyright owner to be able to do a license. Do you use like contribution agreements or how do you ensure that you can relicense the code?
Yeah, so this gets into the part where I will want to mention, like, generally speaking, if I say something about the projects I work on, there is actually like a part-time, I think, lawyer which kind of handles things, so I don't do this happily enough. But to my understanding, what we actually do is, for example, for contributions, for small contributions, we simply have like a content license agreement, as you said. And for stuff like, you know, people want to contribute to GitHub, you don't want to bother people a lot with a PR, you can basically automate all that stuff in that you can just send people a link and tell them like, hey, can you please sign this here? Or it's even something like written consent, like I agree with the license, just type that as a comment. And then, you know, I don't even have to look for the comment. I just know that the CLA bot is telling me like everything is fine. So I think from that perspective, it's easy enough to automate. And a lot of companies do it via the CLA. So like Canonical, I believe that this most Apache Foundation projects work that way, where Apache actually reserves the right to all the code via CLA. I think ours actually, we inspired it from the Apache Foundation. But I guess the issue starts being, you know, when you have people that are bringing in potentially major contributions, right? Like if someone spent like a month on a patch, you know, maybe at some point you're like, well, maybe it's unethical to just, you know, take this code away, right? Maybe the person doesn't want to sign a CLA for it, right?
How do you handle dependencies? Because if you, I don't know about the software which you're using, but I guess it uses some libraries, some GGPL libraries. And then when you would relicense it under a commercial license, all those GPL libraries would still trigger the GPL, wouldn't they?
So this is, see, this is the point where I am not a lawyer comes into play. Because I actually did a bit of reading into this, and I'm quite confused about a few things. So, for example, you have something like libc that's used by GCC, right? And that's under GPL in theory, and that's like linked in a lot of places. And you have Google, for example, I think, like they literally have their own libc. They or Apple or people that use Clang, they have like the MIT license, however Clang calls their libc, right? Mm. But GNU libc is GPL, and people link it in a lot of projects, and like nobody has gotten sued for using it. At the same time, I think our stance at the moment, and this is kind of lucky just because of the environment we're in, is we don't really have GPL dependencies. In that, you know, there's a quick script that I use to basically look like, okay, is there any GPL dependency? And in principle, the idea is, okay, don't have GPL dependencies. I guess that's, you know, that was the recommendation. That being said, like, again, this is something quite confusing, and I haven't found anyone to like solve the confusion. And this is kind of where GPL breaks down, because arguably, right, almost any software that you pile on like half the machines in the world, it's in some way has something from like libc linked to it, or will run in an environment with libc. Or, you know, some code from libc might have been inlined into it for some optimization. Like, well, I guess if it's just Python code, it's fine. But like if you compile it with Cython, for example, then suddenly you've statically linked a GPL license thing. And
but if we're talking about the GNU libc, that is that is under the LGPL. So then linking doesn't trigger it.
Ah, okay. So I didn't actually know that. I didn't know that. So LGPL would not be triggered by linking.
Yeah.
Not dynamically, at least.
Well, no, but statically, would it not be triggered statically? Because I'm thinking like static linking.
I'm not a lawyer.
That's what I said. Really, what I was. You know,
it doesn't matter if it's linking or dynamic. Static or dynamic.
Okay.
And the same thing would apply to using the kernel, like assuming that you're using the Linux kernel. So Linux is released on the GPL version 2 and version 2 only, but everybody can link to that without a problem. And that's because of
But I think exception. The kernel has an explicit exception.
Yeah, they do. So it's an exception there.
So that the user land link interface does not trigger the GPL. So anyone can run their own libc in the user land, and that doesn't consider it to be linking to the kernel. But they explicitly say that we use GPL, and in this case, you do not trigger the GPL, just so that you can build a proprietary user land on top of the open source kernel, so to speak.
And I don't know where this started. This depends on static or dynamic linking, but the lawyers I've spoken to, and some of them are respectable, all of them say that it doesn't matter. So I trust them fully.
Yeah.
That's good. Yeah, we're not lawyers either, but Henrik has some lawyer acquaintances.
Perhaps I'm a lawyer wannabe. No.
But there's another aspect to dual licensing that's kind of interesting. So I'm an Avid Qt user, and they also use the dual licensing. And the way that they ensure... So they sell developer seats. So if we were in a team, they prevent the rest of the team from using the GPL version and me just using the license to compile the actual release by having a quite complicated and strong end user license agreement for the commercial customers. Do you have similar problems, or how do you ensure that your paying customers keep on paying?
So I think in my case, like in the case of MiceDB, the thing that I work on, this is not a perfect example, because our main idea is if you're an enterprise institution with a lot of customers, then we want money. If you are like two guys in a team that work on a project that happens to use it, whatever, right? At least for now, I think that's the stance. And usually with enterprise customers, the idea is that they want the extra features anyway. And I think that's, so I think that's actually a lot of the maybe reason why people would want to do a license. It's not so much the idea that you want people to pay you when they use it in something commercial, right? Like in our case, again, I'm not a lawyer, but I think that we don't have something like AGPL, something similar. So you could use it behind the scenes and be fine. It'd be like legal, even if it's the open source version, even if it's in a proprietary product. But again, not a lawyer, not the official word of the company. but the more the idea, I think, is more so that if you can do a license the thing, that means that you can add proprietary features yourself without issues, right? So you can make an abstraction of the license because it's your thing, and you can have a version. You might, you know, you might even release the actual code of the enterprise version under something that's, well, I guess you couldn't, because the whole idea would be you don't want the code of the enterprise version to be distributed to everyone. So you have to kind of release it under something that at least says like, hey, you can't give this to everyone. So I think that's the basic idea. And then the issue arises with like, okay, you have to kind of modify the same code base. You have to kind of use the same code base. So I think that's one of the main drivers. But again, maybe I'm wrong here, and there is a way to do it with, even if you just have a single GPL, though I don't think so. And I think the other driver is just the fact that since you are starting with a GPL, it's easier to move into something like AGPL if you get into a position where, you know, actually you have quite a good product, but cloud providers have decided they just want to kind of, well, not steal it, but, you know, use it as a service and try to, instead of paying you, kind of go around the license, as is the case with a lot of databases and AWS, GCP, etc.
Unless they use, unless they just pick the latest version that was pre-AGPL, and then they size.
Yeah, and then they patch it themselves.
That you can never protect against, really.
No, but at that point, it's like, you know, would they actually prefer to you know, develop the database? And so, like, probably not. Probably they prefer to just pay a much smaller amount to the original team that actually knows, you know, the product.
But then the business model to keep customers paying is basically that you provide these proprietary features and kind of support and continuous development.
Yeah, to some extent, it can even be, I think, you know, if your customers are mostly people that would use it on a server, it can be like, you know, you have a product that's AGPL. Again, this is more the case with like databases, and then I guess you can even just provide like, hey, here's a proprietary license. You can use it as you wish. And then maybe like prioritize bugs and some support. But like you want to support users and to debug things anyway. So it's not like,
yeah,
you know,
because
the company is doing much.
I'm just thinking that for that use case, you don't need to have dual licensing. You still can, they can still take the GPL version, and they still can pay you for fixing bugs, prioritizing, and so on and so on. So there would be, I think I would make a difference there.
But I suppose it's more about when you sell it to an enterprise that does want to use it for as part of another application, which they consider to be, well,
okay,
unsuitable,
yeah,
for release.
Yeah.
But I guess you also sell then like a service level agreement and so on. It comes in a bigger package, I would assume.
So the dual license would be then more so to get rid of the GPL, to not need to trigger the GPL when they release their own stuff, basically.
Yeah. But just a question around what you do. Do you feel that it works? Do you get paying customers, or do you feel that some customers use the open source version? And also, do you get this open source community and sort of the benefits of many eyes and many hands?
So I don't want to like disclose internal sort of like customer stuff like that.
It's okay not to ask.
I think it's better to look at, I think, like, honestly, I think here it might be better to look at projects that are a bit more mature. So I think, well, Qt might be a good example, but probably not the best. I think something like MariaDB, which I want to say uses the same model, but I'm not 100% sure. So let me actually check.
Ninja googling.
Yes, I'm. You know, I don't want to misrepresent them. So yes, they use like the LGPL license. So like I feel like for those projects, it's not an issue really. And you know, MariaDB like does have the nonprofit foundation, but then there's like a for-profit branch of it. So you know, I don't like personally as like a potential contributor, I don't really see a case where like the fact that some, you know, some software is being dual licensed is like affecting my will to contribute. Like, again, there is this idea of if it's a very large patch, then I feel like, okay, I don't want to give my work and then someone else benefits. I don't have the same benefits. But like, how often do you have those users that come in with like a huge patch? And at that point, if they do that, like, wouldn't you actually want to like pay them or hire them, right? Like if someone came to me with like, oh, here's like 3 months of work that like is totally, you know, awesome and add some features that you guys couldn't do, like it's not like I wouldn't try to like hire that person. It might still be an issue for like some contributors, I guess, the ones that want to do it purely for like idealistic reasons, like let's move as fast as we can towards a world where everything is open source. I'm honestly not sure how many of those people do actually exist, though. So,
no, and as you state, I mean, the one of the benefits of for a commercial enterprise to work with open source component is the hiring. I mean, it's really hard to find good engineers, and that's probably the best way to sort of know that you get the right people, especially if they've already contributed.
Absolutely.
And just the fact that you can like again, in our case, because we are a smaller company, we don't have like enough, let's say, well, we have a lot of contributors, but not a lot of large ones. So usually when we hire people, we actually put out an issue that's like, you know, solve this for hire, so to speak. We actually pay the people that solve it. So like, you know, if you talk with us beforehand and we agree, we give you like whatever, a fair consulting amount per hour to actually solve the thing. But that's really hard to do, I think, in a proprietary company. Like, you know, either you can send like a toy problem, or you can send like, well, are you going to send like a large chunk of your code base? Even if you say like, well, it doesn't matter, someone from HR will, or from, sorry, like legal will have an issue, right? So, you know, that's actually, I think, a fairly good advantage. Like, yes, you can pick from contributors, but even if you don't have like super active contributors, even before that stage, you can actually, you know, pay people to work on the thing before sort of like hiring them and you know, kind of have them fix just very small issues, which in a large company just wouldn't work, because again, you would have to sign a lot of paperwork before you can do that. You would have to give them access to your internal system, because not everything is on GitHub.
It's more like a bounty type system then.
Yeah, exactly. Like a bounty type system. Again, the way we do it is like, you know, you have to talk with us before doing it, because we don't want to guarantee that we'll pay you, you know, before we know you. But yeah.
But what you've been saying about you as a contributor, you wouldn't have a problem and so on. I'm thinking that in theory, this problem arises mostly of the CLA, not the dual licensing. Perhaps both, but one part is the CLA, which you need to sign, where you give away your rights to your code, which in theory you wouldn't want to do it as a company, but in theory you could have make it so that you don't have a CLA and everybody who contributes still keeps the rights, and if you want to sell it, you always ask them, is it okay? So just again, those two parts are different, I think.
I mean,
but just a second. And I think in this one, I've been talking about this one video with Richard Stallman, where he was trying to explain that it's better to have dual licensing, the software as dual licensed, than just proprietary. And for that reason, he was basically for that to be able to still keep the software open and free instead of the need to close it because of all the other things to be able to sell it.
But, we discussed the contributor agreements in a different pod episode a while ago, and which gave a kind of broader view on what it might be. I mean, the contributor agreement could just be that you give away the right to relicense and nothing else. That could be enough in some cases, I guess. And, you know, depending on how broad you make it, that could affect the sort of acceptance from the developer community, I guess.
That's true, yeah.
So are you using some sort of template CLA, or have you developed your own?
I believe so. The one that I kind of liked, and I think that's used as a template for ours. Sadly enough, I must admit, I actually never took the time to read ours entirely. I read the important points, but it's basically Apache license, Apache CLA inspired. With, I think, a few changes, but again, not a lawyer. I think the main problem with CLAs, and I mean, I think to some extent with all these kind of like licensing legal documents, is the fact that they are too wordy. And part of me even thinks like, why is that relevant anymore? Because like, it's not like this is going to be judged in a US court, right? Like if there is a company that you actually have to sue because of license issues, higher chances are that you want to do that in an international court. I'm not sure, you know, how much this language is even valid there. So, you know, I think the one thing you could do there is probably try to tone down on the language, because like at the end of the day, you know, I think that the restrictive language, at least to some extent, is meant to like catch 100% of the people that could be doing something wrong. But you might as well just catch 99%, and that should be fine. And people could actually read the CLA. Like, it could be like 10 lines, like, hey, you give us the right to relicense, and you don't have the right to relicense, period. Yeah. And, you know, that's a very nice, succinct CLA. But
actually, I'm writing a book about QML together with an ex-colleague, and we have a CLA because we want to be able to print it, but the CLA says that all your patches are permissively licensed. I think it's BSD or something. So basically we tell them that we will give you attribution, but we will then relicense your work towards the printer. Which I like, because the BSD license is very few lines. So I mean, it's easy to read, and it's an established thing, and we just point at it and say that this is, if you give us a patch, these are the terms that you have to sort of.
So in this case, patch is like for a book, like for actual text, not for code, right? Or,
well, text or an example code in the book.
Oh, it's all a book the with code. Okay, I get it.
Yeah, exactly. But the example code is already permissively licensed, because we want people to be able to build whatever based on the licenses and not or on the example code and not have to retype it. We just want to be able to go to a publishing house and say that we have the rights to actually print this for you.
What's the book about, by the way, out of curiosity?
And QML, so cute markup language. So if you go to qmlbook.org, you actually find it there. So it's all available openly, and all the material is on GitHub. And all we want to be able to do is to keep the door open to put it to paper. We haven't invested the time needed to do that yet, but still, we don't want to close that door if somebody shows up and wants to print it. Hint, hint, nudge, nudge.
Yeah. So, Johan, this is your second book on Qt, at least. Yeah. How did you handle it in the first book?
The first one was basically Apress looking for contributors. So that was written for them under their I mean, I licensed them
completely
sort of unlimited license. I think I'm still the copyright holder, but they have all the rights for like distribution.
I see.
They also made me write it in a Word that I hated for a year. So now it's Markdown.
Finally.
Couldn't you just have used Markdown and then just pandocked it over to Word?
I mean, the problem was the reviewing, I can tell you, because then someone did all the little changes and you had to sit and click approve, 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 approve. And I'm not a native speaker, so they had a nice American woman who just went through the whole book and fixed all my grammar. And of course, I approve all her changes. It's the biggest pain was actually that I spelled color with OU throughout all examples and example screenshots. So I had to redo like half of the screenshots and a lot of example code because she wanted the American spelling of color. So it's, you live and you learn.
All right. So moving back to the dual license thing, I have a question. To you, George, that I mean, the idea is that most enterprise users, they don't want to release the resulting product that in which they use your library. Do you have a feeling for whether or not it's motivated that they don't want it, or if it's just like, oh, GPL is dangerous? Is it based on an actual business case, or is it more like fear, uncertainty, and doubt?
I feel like, you know, in principle, with all enterprises I've seen, not just in this case, like, it's mainly based on, like, I don't want legal liability, right? Like, after a point, at least the way I understand kind of large businesses, liability becomes a very, very large issue, right? So you are going to spend a relatively large amount of money to get a bit more assurance, right? Like, that's in part why large companies pay quite a lot for support that's, you know, better, but not like worth thousands of dollars better, or at least not in the eye of like a common user, but in the eye of a company where like a 1 hour delay could cost them like a lot of money. It is. And I think it's the same with liability, right? Because you've like, in a large company, liability can mean a lot, right? Like, if, you know, depending on how it can be argued that, or like in what revenue streams it can be argued that you used whatever thing that is, right? Like, it, you know, even a small liability risk, like a 0.01% added, if it's a revenue stream of like 10 billions, well, that's like 10 millions that you are saving by not having that piece of legislation, which you are not like 100% sure of in there, right? So I think that's in part the motivation in a lot of cases where businesses don't want to use GPL. I mean, you know, that being said, allegedly there's, you know, like testimonies that, you know, companies like Goldman Sachs have stolen GPL code and used it in ways that are 100% like not allowed by the license, and nothing has happened to them. And the, you know, some of the person that have reported that have been like arrested and are being held indefinitely on various charges of things. So it's, you know, it's not like any business, you know, will be afraid of this. But I think in general, that seems to be the trend. Like, why do it when you can just pay a small amount and not do it, or where you can.
Yeah. So it's more like we can keep it secret, so then we do it.
Or there's a risk we won't be able to keep it secret, so then know.
Yeah, let's close the door.
Okay.
Yeah. But in general, the open source license that you have is GPL, or was it a Fero GPL, or were a strong copyleft one?
So the one we have, I actually don't want to make a definitive claim about this, because again, I am probably more aware about licensing issue with other things than with my own thing, but it's basically GPL free, right? Like, it's GPL free, but I am not a lawyer, right? Like, it is a version of the new general public license. So I don't want to specifically say like, oh, this is the thing, because I'm unsure.
But have you did you do an evaluation around different licenses? I mean, I guess from having a permissive license would prevent the dual license model, because then anyone else can also dual license.
Yeah, exactly.
It. You need to go in that direction. But have you? Do you know what ranges of licenses you investigated?
So actually, I think I don't take credit, but I think like 1 year and something ago, I prompted the quest for licenses to some extent, at least. Memory serves, but essentially, like we were MIT at the time, I believe, and the decision was made to switch to GPL3. Again, caveat: maybe there is a difference from GPL3, but it should be basically just GPL3, like without the A or the L. I think the range that was investigated was basically around like GPL licenses. There wasn't really a question of should we go semi-proprietary. So like there was never a question of free as opposed to open, right? Like have it be free but not open. I think that's the one interesting area where you can go to. Like I think for some software, it's okay for it to probably be free but not open, right? As in, like, if it's just a high-quality piece of software, but it being open is not that relevant. So think, I don't know, something like Sublime Text Editor, right? I'm not sure if that's open source or not, but I'd be kind of fine with that being closed source, right? But then with something like, let's say, a machine learning library or a encryption library, right? Obviously, there, like, even if it's not free, you definitely want it to be open, right? Like you definitely want to see, to be able to poke around inside. Because, you know, otherwise you're not going to be able to use it for the kind of high stake problem that you actually would want to use it for, I guess. Because you don't have a lot of certainty in what it's doing.
Yeah, and it's very expensive to debug if you just have a binary release to work against when it's something that's so highly integrated.
But maybe this is just me being idealistic, but I'm sort of opposed to the idea that I would be fine with using Sublime just because it's free as in beer. Because for the same reason why I'm not comfortable with using Microsoft Windows, there's no way I can know what the program is doing while I'm using it and while I'm not using it. So it makes me uncomfortable not knowing. I mean, I don't check the source code for Vim every time I use it either, but I trust that enough people have.
Yeah, there's some insane person that has hopefully checked.
Yeah, that it doesn't send all my computer strokes to some server and so on. But for Windows or for other proprietary software, yeah.
There's a mix in VS Code where VS Code is free software, but basically like half of the extensions are not, and they are just downloaded from the internet. You don't really know that you're doing it because you're just installing some extension, and that's downloaded and it's proprietary. And then it's a binary which does something, and which is an interesting mix of both worlds, basically.
But then again, like there is the famous example of the JavaScript library, like I think Color Login Library, right? That could have stolen credit card info, but didn't because the guy was nice, right? But like just as a showcase, like here's how I can get this into like, you know, thousands. I'm not sure. Do you guys know what I'm talking about?
I get it that he has a nice hook to sort of extract whatever he likes.
Yeah, exactly. So
let's write the regex and catch all the.
I'm going to search for the article. Do you have like show notes for the podcast?
Yeah, of course we have show notes. So we'll drop links there, and we also want links for your like recruitment jobs and stuff like that. So yeah, we'll add those definitely.
Yeah, but I think Tobias is more talking about like a moral standpoint, not what can you do, just am I comfortable with, basically.
Well, but I agree with him in that case. Like, I only use open source, basically. I don't think I have a single proprietary thing on my machine other than maybe projects that I'm working on. So, you know,
and
I'm trying to be the best DevOps advocate. Zoom, exactly. That's one. But it's actually installed on this computer for this specific podcast because I wanted to have a good microphone. And usually I will only use it from the proprietary device, which sort of I've kind of you know, I gave up. I had like a moral line. Like I can't use the phone.
I mean, I've done the same thing. I also have an Android phone, so it's sort of.
But isn't the thing that the difference between your arguments that, I mean, when it comes to Sublime or something that you as an end user use, you only use it for your own needs. So then it's really up to you how strongly you feel about like the freedoms of the user and if it's important. While if you use something like an AI machine learning library or something like that, you actually build a product on it and that you give to someone else. So you sort of give something in your name and you trust your supplier then or sort of the upstream package. And there it's much more important that you can sort of know what you give to someone else.
Yeah, and I think actually that's a good point. I was thinking more about magnitude, but yeah. Like, yes, it also matters kind of how many. Well, I guess with Sublime you could argue something like Sublime introduces malicious code that adds like whatever SQL injections into like the files that people save into it, but it's more far fetched.
Yeah, and you could find out by just looking at your own code.
But yeah, like with encryption libraries, there's plenty of examples of like our random number generation actually generates the same number every single time. Someone caught on to that, and he did not tell us. That was a
problem.
That's
the problem. That's
maybe they
problem
used
with
the
random
once.
Numbers. And that's a problem with random numbers. Even if it's the same number every time, you never know if it's random or not.
Well, it's a question of actually one interesting thing if you want to look at it from machine learning perspective. This is just completely unrelated, but I like this sort of factoid. Take like any sort of like scikit-learn model, like multilayer perceptron, gradient booster, whatever, and generate like a sample of random numbers, like from, I don't know, NumPy random or math.random, and like just try to have it predict the next random number based on the previous whatever 10 values, and actually it gets like much better than random. Like the simplicity of the machine learning model that's required to actually perfectly learn a random number, or not perfectly, but like fairly well learned random number generator, is like surprisingly tiny. Like I would have thought like it would have been a hard problem. Apparently not for a lot of those out there.
But is it because we only have pseudo random numbers and we are not using some physics stuff to create those numbers? I don't know.
Presumably,
yeah, I mean, a pseudo number generator is you know, math based. An actual random number generator would not be random in the mathematical sense. It would be arbitrary. I suppose one of those you could not predict.
Yeah, exactly. Like the problem is that basically when people say random, they kind of mean two things. Like I want this to be arbitrary, but also over not such a big number of samples, I want it to be like uniformly distributed. And I don't think you have something that, like in nature, you have uniformly distributed or arbitrary. I'm not sure you have like both uniformly distributed and arbitrary, but you know, I'm not a physicist, so maybe you do somewhere.
Yeah. I used to remember the pictures of lava lamps.
Maybe it's a new thing we'll have to add. Instead of saying I'm not a lawyer, we'll have to add as well, I'm not a physicist. We'll talk
about these things. And we need to say that we need to bring a physicist onto the show to clarify this.
Oh, yeah. Okay, cool.
But we're ever so slowly running out of time. It's been really nice talking to you. But do you feel there's something more you want to add around the licensing topic?
No, I feel like we've exhausted the subject quite well, considering I know nothing about it. It's surprising how much we can talk about it.
Well, we're five engineers trying to do a lawyer's job. So, but it was really great having you on the show. So thanks a lot for joining us.
All right. And thank you guys for having me.
Thanks.
Yeah. Bye-bye.